Lecture 11, The First Intermediate Period.
Hello again. Remember last time I was telling you about the changes at the end of the Old Kingdom? Well, for Egypt, change is always bad. Always leads to something bad, and it's going to lead to the First Intermediate Period. But let me review the changes that we saw. The last king of Dynasty 4 didn't even build a pyramid. Shepsefkaf, remember, builds the Mastabat al-Faroun in the desert. And then, 5th Dynasty, we get kings changing their names to have Ra at the end, or Re, solar gods. They build temples rather than big pyramids. They're building solar temples. There are all kinds of changes. The last king of Dynasty 5 starts putting pyramid texts on the walls. I think the priests are controlling things. But anyway, at the end, we saw Dynasty 6, the last dynasty of the Old Kingdom, end with Pepi II, the longest reigning monarch in the history of the world, ruling for 94 years. And the suggestion was that maybe he just got too old. Maybe he just couldn't lead that army in battle anymore. Maybe he couldn't control the government anymore. And Egypt just declined. There's another theory. I should be fair to Kurt Mendelssohn. There's another theory about why Egypt took a nosedive. Now, Kurt Mendelssohn is not an Egyptologist. He's a physicist. He's dead now. He's a physicist who had a theory about the pyramids and pyramid building. And his book, it's a wonderful book. It's called Riddle of the Pyramids. It's one of those great books and rare books that's mostly wrong but still worth reading. You know, he didn't get it right, but he's an intelligent man thinking through things. And his theory about why there was a decline was that, remember after the 4th Dynasty, after those great pyramids of Sneferu and Cheops and Khafre, there were no longer any big pyramids built? His idea is that that's why the government declined. What happened was you had 90,000 guys working on a pyramid, and all of a sudden, maybe the priests convince the pharaohs not to build big pyramids anymore. What do you have? Unemployed laborers. And maybe you have this large workforce, no longer employed, they revolt, cause problems, and maybe that's the reason for the decline. That was Mendelssohn's theory. I don't think it's right. I think most of the laborers were farmers who were free during inundation, and they went back to their farms. But I just wanted to be fair and give you another theory. So, in any event, the Old Kingdom ends with a lot of changes and a decline. Then comes the Intermediate Period. It's a period about which we know hardly anything. It lasts for as long as the United States has been a country. Nearly 200 years it lasts. And we hardly know anything. It's a curious thing that you can have a Dark Ages for so long. But that's how long Egyptian history is. Now, how do you reconstruct history when you don't have any records? There are practically no records of this period, right? It's a problem. Because remember, it's the government that kept the records in ancient Egypt. Private people didn't keep records. Private people couldn't write most of them. Well, we use various sources. And I'm going to tell you today about the First Intermediate Period, about what happened, what we think happened. But I'm also going to use it to try to show you how Egyptologists piece together a picture of a period that we don't know much about. One source. It's called Manetho. He's a priest. He's an Egyptian priest who was alive at the time of the Ptolemies. Now, these are the Greeks who ruled Egypt at the very end of the civilization. Manetho was alive in the 3rd century BC, and he wrote a history of Egypt called Egyptiaca, Egypt, about Egypt. Now, the virtue that Manetho has is he's an Egyptian priest. He's an insider. He had access to temple records. He could read the hieroglyphs. So he's going to write a history of Egypt. But it's called Egyptiaca. That's Greek. Now, why is he writing in Greek? Well, the answer is that Egypt is being controlled by Greeks. He is writing for his king, who's a Greek. So he writes a history of Egypt in Greek so that the pharaoh, Ptolemy II, can read it. And he can read about the glorious history of Egypt. Now, what is Manetho, our source, say about this First Intermediate Period? What does he say about it? Well, first of all, we don't have the original text of Manetho. His original work is lost, but he's quoted all the time in later historians, guys like Eusebius and Africanus, later historians. And we have their quotes. What did Manetho say? He says of the Intermediate Period, there were 70 kings in 70 days. What does he mean? Now, first of all, I'm pretty sure he didn't mean it literally. It's a very high turnover of pharaohs. What he probably means is that there were many pharaohs who didn't reign very long, that these were kings who didn't last. That's one possibility. Almost always in Egyptian civilization, when you get kings with short reigns coming one after the other, it's a sign that there's something wrong. Stability is when you get a king reigning for 20 years, another 20 years, 10, 15 years. But when you get short reigns, there's a problem. So Manetho says 70 kings in 70 days, maybe short reigns. I'll give you another possibility. There may have been simultaneous kings. There may have been, for example, as you remember, the capital is Memphis in the north. You may have had people in the north claiming to be king. That could be. And then in the south, you may have other people who are kind of ruling in the south saying, I'm king. So you may even get simultaneous kings. Right? So there's a lot of possibilities here, a lot of possibilities. One thing we know about the intermediate period is the capital changed. At some point, see, dynasties 6 and 7 are in the intermediate period. They're in Memphis. But then the capital moves south to a place called Heracleopolis. Now, Heracleopolis is the Greek name that the Greeks called it. They associated it with their god Heracles, so it's Heracles City. But in ancient Egyptian times, during the intermediate period, there was a god there called Herishef, who was a ram-headed god. And we know the capital moved from Memphis to the south, Heracleopolis. That suggests something big happened. Either the kings couldn't rule anymore in Memphis, there's a takeover, the priests have said the gods are more important here. I mean, it's a big deal to move a capital. Think about moving our capital from Washington, D.C. I mean, you know, Egypt had a big bureaucracy, believe me. And it wasn't an easy thing. The records were in Memphis. The scribes were in Memphis. It was a big deal. So there may have been kings all over the place. We just don't know. But Manetho is a key source. 70 kings, 70 days. That's all we know. What other sources do we have? Well, one of the prime sources, when we're trying to figure out which kings ruled when, are the kings lists. The pharaohs were very proud of their continued lineage. They love to trace their heritage back from him to him to him to him to him. It's like the Begats in the Bible, and it's like people today tracing back their lineage to the Mayflower. Genealogy is big now. It was big then. Now, the king's lists were carved on temple walls often, or even just on stones, sometimes written on papyrus, listing all the previous kings. So as soon as you became king, you started writing, well, I'm now, and before me was so-and-so, before me was so-and-so, before me, and you trace it back as much as you can. Now, we have lots of these kings' lists. One is called the Palermo Stone. It's fragments. It's just pieces. But it's a long, dark stone that has carved on it the reigns of pharaohs and even things that happened during their reigns. So it's an important source for us. But the problem with the Palermo Stone is the intermediate period begins with Dynasty 7. The Palermo Stone goes up to Dynasty 5. It's not going to help us. It's a real early monument. So that won't work. Another king's list, the Karnak list as it's called. It was once carved on Karnak Temple, which is in Thebes, south. That has 61 kings up to the time of the pharaoh Thutmose III. But it doesn't tell us anything about the intermediate period. It doesn't help. Now there's another one, maybe one of the best, is the Abydos king's list. Abydos, remember, is the sacred city where Osiris was eventually buried, where the early kings had their burials. And a later pharaoh, Seti I, built his temple at Abydos. And on the wall, inside one of the rooms, he created what he called the Hall of the Ancients. It was his genealogy table, listing the kings from Narmer to Seti I. And it wasn't just a list. No, this was used in a ritual. Once a year, the pharaoh would come into this Hall of the Ancients, and he would look at this list of kings' names, and he would start to read them. Now, why is he reading the names of the kings? Well, above the kings' names is a prayer. And the prayer says, may the king grant the wish to Anubis, and it's a funerary prayer. And it says, may the god give bread and beer, food, cattle, geese, and oxen, all things good and pure upon which the god lives. may he give all these things to these kings. So by reading the names of these kings, they're going to get food, bread, beer, clothing, alabaster, linen, everything needed in the next world. So a king list is important, but it doesn't help us with the intermediate period. We still really don't know. The one that would have helped us most is the Turin Papyrus. It listed originally 300 kings. We can tell by its length. But it was written on papyrus, and the papyrus is badly damaged, and we just really can't reconstruct the intermediate period from there. It's a problem. So the kings list don't help us much. Manetho, 70 kings in 70 days. What do? Well, you turn to literature. There is fiction. Not written right during the intermediate period. As I say, we hardly have any literature from that time. What we do is we go to fiction written during the next period, called the Middle Kingdom, just after. And there's a body of literature called Lamentations. It's where people are complaining, right? It's lamenting. And it's a large genre. There's plenty of papyri that talk about this. And it gives us an insight into what was going on in this intermediate period. And I'm going to read a little bit to you of Lamentations. But let me tell you first about my favorite example of a lamentation. There's a papyrus that's called The Report of a Dispute Between a Man and His Ba. B-A. Ba. The Egyptians believed that a person was made up of many parts. The physical body, that's part of it. But there's also a soul. Now, the soul had lots of different parts, aspects. One was called the Ka, K-A. That's sort of like a physical double. And you could have a Ka statue even. In case your mummy was destroyed, you'd have at least something that looked like you. So that's the Ka. But probably the most important part was the Ba. The Ba was your personality. It's what makes you you. And they used to represent the Ba in a kind of curious way. You'll see it drawn on tomb walls and in papyri, in books of the dead. It's got the head of a man, the deceased, and the body of a bird. And the idea is that this Ba could kind of flit in and out of the tomb until it was time to resurrect. So you had, and there were other parts too, but the important parts are the body, the Ka, and the Ba. Now, this papyrus, the report of a dispute between a man and his Ba, talks about a man who's about to commit suicide. He's really unhappy. It's probably the intermediate period. And he laments. He says, there's no justice in the world. Things are terrible. He says, I have no one to talk to. Brothers kill each other. You know, all kinds of horrible things he describes. And he says, I'm going to kill myself. Now the Ba steps in and talks to him. That's why it's a report of a dispute between a man and his Ba. And the Ba says, uh-uh, don't kill yourself. It's wrong. Now it's interesting. It's a kind of philosophical discussion. Is suicide justified? Sort of interesting. And the man tries to, no, I'll tell you what I'll do, Ba. You know, I'm going to kill myself. And the Ba says, I'll tell you what happens. You kill yourself, I'm going to desert you. You're not going to have me in the West, in the next world, and then you can't resurrect. And the man says to the Ba, he's talking to his soul, he says, listen, I will make for you a tomb that will make every Ba envious of you. You're going to have the best tomb ever. Just don't desert me. And the Ba says, no. You kill yourself, you're out of immortality. Now, the papyrus ends. We don't know. It breaks off. It's damaged. We don't know what happens in the end, right? But at least we've got a guy lamenting, complaining, thinking about suicide, and the Ba says, it's wrong, don't do it, right? I'll desert you. Now, that's a lament. It's my favorite because it's kind of personalized. But there are more. It's a whole genre. And let me give you an idea of the kinds of things that people were saying in these lamentations. It's kind of neat. You'll see. This is a lament. It's written in the Middle Kingdom. But you'll see, it's got some funny things in it. He says, this is somebody complaining, right? It's talking about the intermediate period, how bad things were. And he says, foreign bowmen, meaning bow and arrow, foreign bowmen have come into Egypt. Now, think about it. For the first time since the unification of Egypt, since Narmer, Egypt is invaded. Bowmen, and that's a sort of negative way to describe foreigners. Foreign bowmen, right? First time, who would have ever thought that the builder of the Great Pyramid, soon after that, Egypt would be invaded? But there are foreigners roaming. And then something much more sort of telltale. It says, lo, gold, lapis lazuli, silver, turquoise, carnelian, strung around the necks of slave girls. Now, what's wrong with slave girls having lapis and carnelian, yeah, nice things? The answer is, divine order is upset. It's turned upside down. See, the Egyptians were the most conservative of all people. They didn't want change. That's why I stressed in the Fifth Dynasty that there's change. That's bad. The Egyptians never wanted change. They were the most conservative people in the world. It's kind of the original, if it's not broke, don't fix it. You know, Egypt was on top of the world. Why would you want change? Now, they believed that there was a divine order that the gods established. And that meant Egypt was at top, ruling the Middle East. It also meant that lords had good things, slaves had not much. That was the way it was supposed to be. Now, who was responsible for making sure the divine order is established and stays put? The pharaoh. The pharaoh. By making offerings to the gods, by going into the temples, the pharaoh would make sure that the gods were pleased, and then divine order would remain. See, it's a little bit like a business deal. I mean, most religion is, in a sense, like a business deal. I mean, what is a priest? It's somebody who intercedes for you to the gods. He's a businessman carrying out the transaction. And that's what the pharaoh was. He was carrying out the transaction of making sure that his company, country, was getting its fair share. So when the pharaoh went into battle, he would come back with lots of booty, and he would give its share to the temple. And then the temples would look on Egypt, and divine order would be restored. But, we've got slave girls wearing lapis. That's not right. That's not right. Everything had its place. You know what it's a little bit like? In Elizabethan times, during the time of Shakespeare, there was the belief in the great chain of being, that everything had its place. And they drew up these long diagrams of how the world was structured according to God's plan. At the top, of course, is God. Beneath God are angels. There's seraphim and cherubim. These are orders of angels. And beneath the angels, you've got man. And, of course, there's a hierarchy there. At the top, you've got the king. And beneath him, the lords. And beneath them, the peasants. It goes all the way down. Beneath man, you've got the plants and animals. There's a king of the animal world, the lion. And you've got lions going down. And then you've got the plants. Now, I don't know what the king of the plants is. Maybe it's broccoli. I don't know. But then beneath the plants, but they're alive plants, you have the minerals, the lowest of the low, the insensitive things. Right? So there was a sense that everything in its place. There was an order, a divine order. And that's exactly what the Egyptians believed in, divine order. They called it Ma'at. Ma'at was a goddess, but also she represented truth, justice, and order. Right? She's often shown, by the way, with a feather on top of her head. That's the hieroglyph for true, means truth. Also justice. So there was this divine order. And that's what they were upset about. Divine order was turned upside down. Let me give you another example. In this lamentation, continuing, he says, none indeed sail north to Byblos today. What shall we do for pine trees for our mummies? Now, what does that mean? Well, what it means is, he wants the great old days of Sneferu, when Sneferu sent out expeditions to Lebanon, to Byblos. That's what he's looking for. He's looking for the good old days. Now, why do you need pines for mummies? The answer is, pine trees were the source of resin. And in order to make a good mummy, you needed resin. After you dehydrated it, you covered the face with tree sap to kind of seal it in. And resin was the way you stuck it together. The mummies were wrapped in bandages. But they didn't have regular glue. They used tree resin. So when he says, none indeed sail north to Byblos today, he's really saying, it's not like the good old days of Sneferu. And that's what he wanted, the good old days of Sneferu. So things are really bad. And he says, you know, this lamentation, what shall we do about it? All is in ruin. I mean, things are really bad. He says, lo, every have-not is one who has. That's just the wrong thing. There's no more sense that, you know, you should really give to the poor or anything like that. No, the poor are supposed to be poor. That's what they're there for. And he's got loads of interesting little tidbits. He says, lo, those who were entombed are cast on high ground. What he means, right, is that people are robbing the tombs. Right? They're robbing tombs, taking the bodies out, and casting them up. Remember, tombs are down in the ground. And people are going into the tombs, taking and throwing them out. Right? You know, to this day, there's a parallel to that in Egypt. The ancient Egyptian word for a cemetery was often the city of the dead. They called it that, houses of the dead. And today in Egypt, there's a city of the dead. It's the modern cemetery in Cairo. And housing is so bad in Cairo that there are something like 500,000 people living in the tombs in the cemetery in Cairo called the City of the Dead. And it's acknowledged by the government even because they've run in electricity for these people, so they just live in the tombs. So some things never change. But he goes on. He talks about this inversion of wealth. He says, wearers of fine linen are beaten with sticks. Right? Not very good. And he continues. He says, ladies suffer like maidservants. Right? I mean, the idea is that maidservants are supposed to suffer. That's their place in life. Right? And he says, lo, all maidservants are rude in their speech. When the mistress speaks, it irks the servants. Right? Things are bad. Now, this is just one example of Lamentations. There's another one which is called the Prophecies of Neferti. And it's supposed to take place in the time of Sneferu. Now, remember, Sneferu is my hero. He's the one who shows Egypt how to build the pyramids. But he's also the guy that they all look back to with the great days. I'll tell you, 1,000 years after Sneferu was dead, 1,000 years after Sneferu was dead, when a pharaoh did something great, they said, not since the time of Sneferu has its like been done. Right? So Sneferu was kind of like the good old days. And there's prophecies that supposedly take place in the time of Sneferu. Somebody's going to make predictions for Sneferu of what's going to happen. And he predicts the first intermediate period. Now, it's not a real prophecy. It's written during the Middle Kingdom. It's looking back, but it's got some wild stuff. It says, lo, the great no longer rule the land. What was made has been unmade. See, they had tradition. What is made has been unmade. What's been unmade? The pyramids. They've been robbed. During this first intermediate period, there was no bodyguards. There were no police state. There was nothing. It was anarchy. So the pyramids are big, hulking targets. And that's when the pyramids of Egypt are robbed. That's why we never find a body in a pyramid. They were all robbed during the first intermediate period. And this man is lamenting. He says, lo, the great no longer rule the land, meaning people like Sneferu. See, you're going to get a theme throughout all the Lamentations. It's first, divine order is upset. And second, we need a champion. We need the king to come out on his horse and ride in with his hat and save us. That's what Egypt always turned towards, a champion, somebody to save them. A couple more things. It's deeper than political problems they felt. It was the gods are angry or something. He says, dry as the river of Egypt, one crosses it on foot. Now that's something very elemental. Even nature is against Egypt. Things have turned against Egypt and they don't know why. He continues, there's more, he says, the land is bowed down in distress, owing to those feeders, Asiatics, who roam the land. Again, there's something wrong. Foreigners are entering into Egypt. Remember, Sneferu is the one who called himself the smiter of barbarians. He's the one who went into the Sinai. Things are bad. And he says, desert flocks will drink at the river of Egypt. Now, what does that mean? Desert flocks will drink at the river of Egypt. What's wrong with that? The answer is that the desert flocks are the Bedouins, the people of the desert. You see, it's a common misconception that the Egyptians were desert folk riding into the desert on their camels. The Egyptians hated the desert, feared it. They didn't have the camel till much later, till the Romans introduced it. The Egyptians stayed away from the desert. Everybody in Egypt lived along the Nile, where the water was. Right? So the desert was feared. And the people of the desert were to be kept at arm's length. Keep them out. So now he says, desert flocks will drink at the river of Egypt. Take their ease on the shores for lack of one to fear. In other words, in the good old days, those Bedouins were afraid to come near our river. They had to look for wells and stay away. But now they come and take their ease. And are what? Things are really bad. See, Egypt was interesting towards foreigners. They didn't really like foreigners in the beginning. Egypt was the place you wanted to be. It was the place where you had to be buried. It was the place where you lived. It was the best place on earth. You know, when an Egyptian went to a foreign country, and it rained. Now, the Egyptians never saw rain, hardly ever saw rain. They said, it's curious. They have their Nile in the sky. And they viewed it as really unfortunate. You know why? They had to just wait for it to come. I mean, you had to, like nowadays, you know, sometimes there's a drought. And sometimes it rains too much. But the Nile, at least, was always there. So Egypt was the best place on earth. And during this intermediate period, it had ceased to be the best place on earth. Why? They must have wondered. They just didn't know. I'll give you one last goodie or two of this lamentation. I love lamentations because it gives you an insight to what these people felt about the land. He says, the land is ruined. Its fate decreed by the gods, right? Deprived of produce, lacking crops, right? Everything's gone. He says, I show you the master's need. The master needs something? Incredible. Never would happen. He says, the land is shrunk. Its rulers are many. It is bare, but taxes are great. So people, they're not producing. The Nile is perhaps dry, and they're still being taxed. Something's really wrong. See, taxes were a symbol to Egypt almost. You know, Egypt is probably the first country that really taxes its people systematically. Egypt was the largest bureaucracy in the history of the world. Think about it. If you've got a strong central government, you got an army, you got to pay that army. How do you get the money, the goods, to pay the army? Egypt didn't have any currency. There was no currency in Egypt. They did barter. It was grain for clothes and this and that. Well, the way you paid the army and the priests and the people who didn't contribute to the society is you taxed the peasants. And how did you tax them? You didn't go and say, give me 1/5 of your grain. No. Because they could cheat. They could hide the grain. They could say we had a bad year. The peasants were taxed by how high the Nile rose. There were nilometers, measurements of the Nile, carved on boulders in the river. And depending upon how high the Nile rose, that's how you were taxed. If the Nile rises, say, up to 22 feet, you're taxed this amount. You should be able to grow this amount of crops if the Nile is this high. You grow that much, you pay it. If you don't, say you had a bad year, you still have to pay that amount. It doesn't matter. You can't hide your grain. If you're lucky, you grow more, you just have to pay that amount. But you're taxed not on how much you grow, but how much you should be able to grow with a Nile of a certain height. So this man's saying, there are no crops, and the taxes are great. Things are really bad. And he says, one salutes he who was saluted. Right? In other words, you're saluting the wrong guys. You know, it's saluting the guy who should be saluting you. And then he says at the end, men will live in the graveyard. A beggar will gain riches. The slave will be exalted. Things are terrible. Divine order is upset. Now, it's from texts like these, which is literature, can't be taken perfectly literally, but we get an insight into what's going on in the intermediate period for 200 years. Now, why do we have to go to texts like these? Well, one thing is that we don't have the official records. Another is that Manetho, our good source, is very scant, 70 kings in 70 days. And there's another reason. You know, the king's list didn't help us much. But the other reason is that in the beginning of this intermediate period, the capital was at Memphis, in the north. And Memphis is a lost city. See, the water table is higher in Memphis. And that means that buildings sink down. It means that papyrus, on which records are written, rots in the moisture. And if you try to excavate at Memphis, it's very difficult. You dig down 3 feet and you're in water. You're in water. It was excavated by Flinders Petrie, my man, the excavator in the 19th century, and he went around with an iron rod poking in to feel where the stones were under the mud and then tried to get the mud out, dig up a stone. But most of Memphis is under the mud. It's gone. It's a lost city. So when I tell you the history of Egypt, I'm really not telling you, in a sense, the history of Egypt from the north. What we know is the history of Egypt from the south, where it was always dry and we have more records. It's kind of like looking under the lamppost for your watch, even though you didn't lose it there because the light's there. It's all we have, really, are southern records. So another reason why the intermediate period is so, so difficult to study is the capital, Memphis, is gone. Now, there's good news. For nearly 200 years, Egypt was in this period of anarchy. The good news is it rises again. It comes out of the mire. We're going to get the champion that they want to unify Egypt. But that's for next time. I'll see you then.